The Tom Woods Show, episode 1318.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, I know from experience that creating online courses is a nice way to start a side business. But how exactly do you do it? Well, I have a teensy-weensy bit of experience with this, and I've assembled some resources that are free that'll show you exactly how to do it. Pick them up at tomwoods.com/makecourses. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. We're talking crypto today, and we're talking about it with Sasha Hodder, who is one of the few experts out there, real experts, on the legal and regulatory aspects of cryptocurrency. And we were absolutely delighted to have her join us on the Contra Cruise this year, and last year, 2018, where she sat on a panel with Tatiana Moroz and Naomi Brockwell, and just absolutely wowed us with her knowledge. And I wanted to bring her on and just ask her about some of these kinds of questions, about the scope of the different regulatory bodies in the U.S. Vis-a-vis cryptocurrency, and some of the privacy measures that are either presently in existence or in development. I want to just get into the details of this stuff. And in fact, I'm even going to have her give you her background. She's got an extensive background in all this. So her podcast is Hodlcast, H-O-D-L-C-A-S-T. And we'll link you to that at tomwoods.com/1318. Sasha, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me on as a guest.
I started to give people your background, and then I realized you know it much better than I do. I've got some stuff here on paper, but what's interesting about you is there aren't that many, frankly, that many people out there who are legal authorities, you know, on the legal implications of cryptocurrency, period. And you are one of them. You also, if you Google your name, you seem to be everywhere. You're well-connected. You know everybody. You have a podcast. So just share with us a little bit about yourself, how you got to be in these circles, and just in general, what your background is.
Oh, thanks. Well, I grew up in Canada, and I was working in the mutual fund industry for quite some time. I was a licensed trader in the U.S. markets as well, working for the banks, and saw the whole 2008 fiasco, and it was just a frustrating time in the working in mutual fund sales, because I couldn't do anything to help my clients other than tell them stay invested, wait it out, and I got kind of jaded, I guess. So I thought maybe going to law school would be like, I couldn't seem to do sales anymore. Like, I just got so sick of going to these investment advisors' offices and trying to get them sold on some portfolio. And we had a portfolio manager, Christine Hughes, that she was always talking about Bitcoin. And anyway, it was just time for me to do a change. I wanted warmer climate and everything. So I moved down to Florida. And when I started law school, I was on a student visa and I wasn't able to work in America. So I thought maybe if I volunteered to a company and received compensation in Bitcoin, it might be kind of a way around that whole student visa situation. It wasn't, like, when I looked deeper into the rules, but it did get me started, like, down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin. And that was 2014. And I started just attending conferences. I became very interested in the potential of this technology. And I met Naomi Brockwell and Tatiana Moroz, who were also on your cruise this summer, like last summer. I met them in 2014 and some other people. And I've just kind of been following the space ever since. And then when I finished law school, I was working at a traditional firm in Jacksonville, Florida. And I kept having Bitcoin people contacting me. Now that I was, you know, a licensed attorney, they wanted certain Bitcoin related legal work, and I was in a unique position where, you know, I could do it for them, but the boss at that firm wasn't comfortable taking on anything relating to Bitcoin. You know, we were doing a lot of insurance defense or just breach of contract, typical business litigation stuff. And so I ended up starting my own firm with my partner Greg Karch and moving to Tampa. And then for the last year, we've just been kind of doing all Bitcoin all day. But it's been quite a ride watching all this new regulations come out around. Or it's like Bitcoin has such great potential, but the regulators it seems like trying to block it or just regulate it, which is kind of impossible with Bitcoin.
Well, incidentally, we certainly were delighted to have you with us aboard the Contra Cruise. What a great time. You had a great panel with Naomi and Tatiana. Tatiana has just brought one. The previous year, she brought Lynn Ulbricht with her, you know, Ross Ulbricht's mother. Just as a bonus for us. It was just unbelievable. So she really, really adds a tremendous value. She brings not only herself, but these wonderful, interesting new people. When you talk about regulation, there's a lot that can be said, but the first one that comes to my mind is not terribly recent, and I still haven't completely wrapped my head around it. And that has to do with the classification of cryptocurrency by the IRS and what the tax implications of cryptocurrency are. And when I heard about this, it really did make me question what I hear from a lot of Bitcoin boosters that, oh, well, you know, you can't really regulate Bitcoin. But if they want to make it taxable, that they can look at, you know, what was the value of your Bitcoin at this time and then at that time and when at the time you made your purchase versus the time you owned it, they could make it, from a regulatory standpoint, impossible for you to use it on a regular basis, couldn't they?
Well, they kind of have. I mean, the thing is, Bitcoiners have some defense against it by making their transactions private. And there's a lot of new technologies that are coming out to enhance privacy. But if you're just using Bitcoin on Coinbase or some other exchange where you've provided your KYC information, it creates the biggest mess in the world because you're expected to calculate your tax basis, like your cost basis, from the time you purchased that Bitcoin to if you used it on Amazon through the Purse application. And we don't have to do that with cash, obviously. You know, you don't have to look and see when you got your cash and when you're spending it and what the difference is. But with Bitcoin, that's what they effectively did with the regulation. And when, like, I started working, a few people, I'm very interested in how they're treating Bitcoin from a tax perspective. And I ended up trying to do a few people's taxes last year. And it was a nightmare. Like, some of them had over 2,000 trades, and just to try and go through and match those up is like a real puzzle. And there hasn't been a single enforcement action that I'm aware of in the United States against an individual for not paying their taxes on Bitcoin. But I think that's probably the next wave of enforcement we'll see coming up. If there's been some, this company called The Block, which is a great crypto news source, one of their authors, Larry Cermak, he published a chart showing government spending on Bitcoin enforcement, and IRS had the largest percentage at 38%, which I would have thought it was going to be the SEC because they're the ones where all the action has been this year, but kind of indicates there might be more coming from the IRS.
Can we compare Bitcoin or cryptocurrency regulation in the U.S. with regulation in other countries? And when we look at when we make that comparison, what do we see?
We see a lot more regulation in the U.S. than anywhere else. And it's not even that we created a lot of new regulation for Bitcoin in America. It's just we're trying to fit it into the existing classifications. And in other countries, they haven't given people any guidance to that. Like, for instance, in Canada, there's no tax being collected on Bitcoin, and there's not really any specific KYC being performed. And same thing in a lot of other countries. Now, on the security side, a lot of countries are coming out and saying that coins generated through initial coin offerings should be regulated like securities. That's kind of happened in a lot of jurisdictions. But then there's other jurisdictions coming out like the Swiss regulatory authority, which has kind of become a leader in the space. They've created new legislation to address this rather than just fitting it all into the existing stuff.
Can you tell us what KYC means? Because you've used that term twice.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, it means know your customer. So when you open a bank account, the banking laws, like the Bank Secrecy Act, requires that the bank track who's got what money. And anytime there's a transaction over $10,000, a suspicious activity report is required to be sent in to FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. And so they want the same regulation around crypto. So if someone's doing an exchange of cryptocurrency for over $10,000 worth of value, that needs to be reported, which is different than crypto. Is so funny because if you're dealing in stocks, like, and you don't have to submit a SAR or suspicious activity report if someone moves $10,000 worth of stocks, but if they're moving cash, you have to submit that report. But they're treating certain cryptos like stocks, but still requiring that report. Or trying to.
Okay, got it. Now, you were saying in an email that we could talk about what you said were two different directions Bitcoin is taking, one path toward regulation and a simultaneous but divergent path towards increased privacy. And of course, we're interested in both of these. And one thing is the state of crypto exchanges. And I guess, I don't know, I use an exchange, and I know that there are people who think that I must be an idiot. And the thing is, when it comes to crypto, I am an idiot. That's the thing. You know, I don't know enough of how it works. And I know now I'm going to get people volunteering. I'll come to your house and show you how to get your own private. I know. And maybe that's a good idea. But first of all, there was an interesting story the other day. I don't remember who it was, but somebody was deplatformed by Coinbase. I mean, we hear this happening on YouTube and Facebook and whatever, and even PayPal. And then Coinbase deplatformed somebody, which, again, I think is kind of contrary to the spirit of Bitcoin. But what exactly is the status
of... You're not an idiot, because I didn't know that story either. You know more about certain news than I do.
Yeah, I'll look at... Well, see, I know the political aspects of things. But what is the status of the crypto exchanges, and what do the various government agencies actually require of them?
Okay, so that's a long list. So they have to typically register for a money transmission license in every state that requires it. In New York, for instance, they need this New York BIT license, which I'm in the process of filling out one right now for a client. And it is insane how much stuff they want. They want 15 years of employment history. We have to hire a private investigator to do a background search on it and send it directly to New York. Fingerprints. They need a full affidavit of his financial situation. They need his personal taxes. His business needs audited financial reports. This is all just to operate an ATM in New York. Like, you don't need that for cash ATM there, but, you know, as far as I'm aware. But because you're converting cash into Bitcoin at the ATM, that's where they say it's, it becomes convertible, and then it needs the money transmission license. And so the exchanges need that as well. And then you also need to register at the federal level, and you need to be able to capture who the individual is that's doing the exchange, which is where that KYC or know your customer comes into place. So there's a lot of information you can glean from someone with their cell phone number, because the cell phone companies are all complying here. So they'll verify that the person's name is who's signed up for that cell phone number. So you collect their cell phone, their email, you know, for higher levels of transactions, their address, and even sometimes their social security number, passport data, a photo of them. And then the exchange would need to send any suspicious activity to FinCEN to comply with the Bank Secrecy Act. So that's a requirement through the FinCEN government organization. Then they also have a requirement under the SEC that if they're trading in securities, which a lot of the tokens have now been classified or guidance has been issued, that they are securities under the investment contract route, which uses the Howey test analysis, saying, you know, basically, if this token or cryptocurrency was sold and the people expected a profit, and the profit was going to come based on the efforts of the company issuing it. So if it's not a decentralized, the difference is, you know, Bitcoin is mined over a network and it is decentralized, and it wasn't initially sold with that, they say, with that expectation of profit based on the efforts of a third party, because you might buy it expecting profit, but it's based on the efforts of a huge network, not a centralized group. And that's kind of where the distinction lies of whether something becomes like Bitcoin, a decentralized commodity, to something like an ICO that has been sold from a centralized body. And if it is a security, then the exchange selling it needs to be a registered securities exchange, and they need to follow all the disclosure protocols and get a broker's dealer's license. And it's quite a mess. And no exchange right now is registered like that. That's what the SEC is telling them that they have to do. And they've started fining. Well, they fined Ether Delta Exchange. They fined the founder of Ether Delta. But it's created just an atmosphere of fear, basically, for the exchange owners right now.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Well, before I forget, I'll just add, I did look it up. It's the alternative social media site Gab, which is kind of like Twitter without the censorship. Apparently, mm-hmm. their founders or their accounts were dropped by Coinbase, presumably because they're controversial, but really they don't censor people unless the person is involved in something illegal. They don't censor people. And so they've gotten in trouble because sometimes you get people saying nasty things on Gab. So Coinbase apparently broke ties with them. So that happened. This is just too depressing. Let's talk more about positive developments here. And again, do you understand why somebody like me, an outsider who doesn't know all the technical ins and outs of Bitcoin, could feel like maybe Bitcoin was oversold a bit by some of its initial boosters, in that we were told that it's so nimble and it can evade regulators and it's hopeless for the state to try to regulate it? But that doesn't sound like what you're describing to me. It sounds like it can be hampered by regulators. So did people overdo it in selling it to us, or did I misunderstand what their claims were?
I think it was a bit of overselling at the beginning, where everyone thought Bitcoin was completely anonymous, that transactions being done, you know, no one could see what it was. But really, then things like Chainalysis were created, and you can really see a lot about the, if you know the transaction, then you can find out the IP address. But there are a lot of features that allow kind of the more technical savvy Bitcoin users to avoid detection. And one of the most exciting developments on that, and I'm not a super technical person, so I haven't used a lot of these technologies myself, but I'm really glad that they're there. And I think they're what will keep Bitcoin relevant in the future. And it's the Lightning Network has come along. And so that, I don't know exactly what happens in it, but basically there's a payment channel that's open and anyone can do any number of transactions in that payment channel. And then only the bulk sum of the result gets sent back to the blockchain, the Bitcoin blockchain. So there's no way for a regulator to look at that and say you and I do a transaction in Lightning, but so do a bunch of other people do it in there. They wouldn't know that you and I, or what our addresses even are, did the transaction. So like, for instance, recently OFAC even went as far as blocking two Bitcoin addresses. And OFAC is like the list of basically known terrorists, or it's thought to be. And the two addresses that got blocked were thought to be responsible for the SAM scam. They basically were defrauding people all over US, Canada, and some other countries. And thought that they got like $25 million worth of ransomware. So OFAC came out and said those two addresses can't be transacted with. But if those two addresses went in the Lightning Network into a payment channel, they still could do a transaction right there. And only the two addresses that opened the payment channel would be reported back onto the Bitcoin blockchain. So it would be undetectable that they did a transaction, as far as that's my understanding of it. And then there's a thing called ring signature transactions, which is the technology primarily used by Monero right now. And that thing too, it's the signature, which is the transaction itself, is endorsed by a group of people rather than one person. So again, like, it eliminates the visibility of the addresses doing the transaction. So it makes the transaction completely anonymous. And then there's these other things called coin joins, which there's a lot of these now. Like, people have taken the initial technology and applied it to several other, like the Mimblewimble protocol. But basically, it obscures the output transaction and it joins the inputs with the outputs. So it takes a bunch of different people's transaction and merges them into one transaction. So it makes it impossible for any blockchain analysis tool to even see it. So the tools that the government are using to detect these transactions and either charge people with money laundering or things like that, or even the taxes, if people are using these privacy solutions, they can't see it. So it's like, we came along with Bitcoin, the government came along with tracking Bitcoin, and then the community developed other tools that make it really difficult to track. And it's probably going to stay in this cat and mouse kind of situation. I don't know how long, but privacy is certainly important with this technology, but it's not the only benefit of Bitcoin. Like, even if you don't care so much about privacy, you can still send a transaction for virtually free, not quite free, but very, very low price, in any quantity to anywhere in the world without having to go through the effort of a wire transaction and the fees that would be involved in that. So it still allows for a transfer of value very quickly and very cost effectively. So there's a lot of benefits to using Bitcoin in the regulated environment still, but if you want the privacy, you can get it just by taking a few extra steps.
Would you be able later on to send me a link or two to information people can read about these different privacy solutions? Because I know listeners will want to follow up on that.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, that'd be good. Now, there are at least four government agencies. I mean, there's the SEC, the IRS, and a couple of others that in one way or another, jurisdiction would touch on Bitcoin. Can you help us separate out what each one of them claims that its rights vis-a-vis Bitcoin are, or its powers vis-a-vis Bitcoin are?
Sure. Yeah. And I think that's where the bulk of the, from the attorney side or the regulation side, that's where it's very interesting that they're all different. Bitcoin is so nimble that it acts as many different things. And so when it's acting like a stock, the SEC looks at it. When it's acting like property, then the IRS is looking at it. When it's acting like money, FinCEN's looking at it. And when it's acting like a commodity, the CFTC is looking at it. So from the IRS side, everything you do, it's taxed just like property. So, and they define it really broadly, and they've only given us one notice, that IRS 2014-21 notice issued in 2014. And there have been so many requests for additional clarification that have not yet been issued. But the way that we have to look at it now is that every transaction you do would be taxed just like any. It's taxed kind of like a stock. Like, you have to figure out your cost basis, and if you had a gain, then that gain is taxable income. As if you hold it over a year, it's going to be a capital gain. If you hold it under a year, it's just going to be added to your regular income tax level. If you have losses under a year, you can write off $3,000 worth of the loss, but that's a total. So like this year, a lot of people have losses. They can carry forward any additional amount than $3,000 to next year and going forward forever. But, it is limited to $3,000 a coin. And then you're supposed to, a lot of people had the thought that you would, once you bought crypto, anything you did in the crypto world was its own thing. You only had to pay tax when you cashed back out to fiat dollars. But if you really, now, I don't think that's the case. Like, people were saying, oh, it's a like-kind trade. And I mean, in real estate property, there is an exception for like-kind trades if you're doing physical property. But you have to fill out your tax form telling the government that you're doing that. Like, I bought my house in 2005. I sold it in 2009. I'm buying a new house, 90 days after I made that first sale. I'm going to keep my 2005 cost basis and just carry that forward into the new house. And you fill a specific form telling the government that you're doing that. But in crypto, everyone was just going back and forth from Ethereum to Monero or other different coins, and then calling it in their head like, oh, well, that's a like-kind exchange, so I don't need to pay tax on any of that. And then Trump came out in 2018 with the new tax code, and he inserted the word real property in front of, he just added that one word. But I think it made it pretty clear to the crypto users that, like-kind trades don't really apply here. So anytime you've moved Bitcoin from one thing to the other, you're expected to have kept track and pay taxes on it. But it's just completely impractical to expect people to do that who've been doing a lot of transactions. So I think they are going to have to put out some kind of additional guidance, or I don't know how they're going to enforce on that, because it would take a lot of government resources to figure out who had what and when. And it's really impractical. I think they should do something like a go forward basis with the taxes. But I'm not the government, and that's probably not how they interpret it.
Folks, let's take just a minute. I want to tell you that next week, you're actually going to be hearing from one of my daughters, Regina, who has taken classes with Skillshare, which is an online learning community for creators. It's got more than 25,000 classes in design, accounting, finance, web development, crafts, culinary, photography, music production, writing, whatever you can think of, there's a class on it at Skillshare. And Regina, well, I'm going to let her speak for herself, but let's just say she's delighted. She's almost addicted to Skillshare. When you join Skillshare, you get access to all 25,000 classes. And in fact, there is a special offer for people listening to this here program. You can join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today with this special offer for you. Get 2 months of Skillshare for free. That's right. Skillshare is offering Tom Wood Show listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 25,000 classes for free. To sign up, you got to go to Skillshare.com/woods free. Again, go to Skillshare.com/woods free to start your 2 months now. That's Skillshare.com/woods free. Well, given that a refrain here has been the government is issuing this requirement, it's preposterous and absurd to expect people to comply with it. It seems like there are two possible interesting outcomes that could occur. One would be you get enough popular adoption of cryptocurrency that eventually you overcome these barriers in the same way that the popular adoption of, not by a majority by any means, but a lot of people homeschooling overcame a lot of the restrictions on homeschooling. It just, they were just swamped by people who said, we're not complying with this and forget about it. And so things actually really did change. I mean, for instance, with changing social attitudes about marijuana and medical marijuana and recreational use of it, well, things actually did change. Every once in a while, that does happen. Now, money, you're really getting to the heart of the regime, so it might be a little bit tougher road to hoe. But that's one possibility. Enough people adopt it that they make enough noise and the regulators have to scale things back. Other,
it's not fair.
First of all, do you think that's plausible? Because the trouble is the existing regulations make it a tougher sell to newbies. You know, I mean, if we could get rid of these, then it would be a lot easier to get the. So it's like a chicken and the egg problem. It would be easier to get more popular adoption of them.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, one statistic came out in a lawsuit against Coinbase by the IRS that only 812 Bitcoin users paid tax, and Coinbase was reporting something like 5 million registered users. So a very small percentage of Bitcoiners were paying their taxes anyway. That was up until 2016. So I don't know what the data is of how many people paid in 2017 or will pay in 18. And that notice, I think, kind of shook people up a bit of like, oh, the IRS is paying attention. And oh, Coinbase was subpoenaed to give all information of users over to the IRS so that they can, you know, calculate how much tax everyone would owe. And Coinbase fought against it for a year in court, actually, and only ended up giving data over of like 14% of its higher end users. But it's likely that every exchange was given the same subpoena, and Coinbase is the only one that fought it, and we didn't hear about it with the other ones. So, but when you say about the adoption, yeah, it's like a company that wants to accept Bitcoin for regular, you know, if Starbucks wants to start accepting it, how are they going to now do the accounting on that if they have to calculate their tax on every single purchase that comes in, the price at that moment in US dollar terms versus the time that they converted it to cash if they converted it? It really creates a barrier for a company wanting to use it. And then there has been proposals to create a de minimis, like anything under $600 or $800 to not be taxed. And that's how we treat other foreign currencies, unless it's a transaction over, I believe it's $800, it might be $600, I can't remember offhand, but that it wouldn't create any taxable event until it's over a transaction larger than that. So if they did that for Bitcoin, that would make it a lot easier for people to use it in an everyday sense. But
right.
We're not there.
Then the other possibility that I was envisioning is that more and more people who do use cryptocurrency begin to adopt some of these privacy measures that you were describing. But here we're now kind of two levels into geekdom. I mean, not just the use of cryptocurrency, but then the super deluxe knowledge of how to use them in a way that is safer and more private for you. And one of the difficulties here is precisely what Jordan Peterson mentioned in a recent video where he's talking about how he and Dave Rubin are trying to come up with an alternative to Patreon because they haven't been censored on Patreon, but they don't like the trend on Patreon where people are just being deplatformed, or Patreon is being put under pressure by credit card companies like MasterCard because they don't like the content of some of the people on the platform. And Peterson just thinks this is a very bad trend and we want to indicate our displeasure with it. And the best way we can do that is, even though Ruben and I make a fortune on that platform, Peterson says, we're going to be leaving it for good on January 15th of this year, and we are going to try to come up with a substitute. The problem is any substitute they come up with is going to have the same problem with payment processors who want to be your mother and tell you what you're allowed to say and do. So PayPal has done that. As we've seen, MasterCard is doing that. So really the only option they've got, it seems to me, is cryptocurrency. And Peterson has not rejected that out of hand. But what he's said is the trouble is it's so off of most people's radar that the likelihood of mass adoption is just seems to be too low. It seems to be too big of a tech demand on most people. They can't wrap their heads around it. They haven't heard of it. So he's not really taking it as seriously as maybe he ought to. And I wish there were a good answer to give him.
Well, actually, JJ from your cruise, he recently created a website called bitbacker.io.
I had him on to talk about that. That is an excellent solution as well. Bitbacker.io, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. But it's still like if YouTube were to deplatform someone, then, you know, you just link the YouTube video to Bitbacker or something. So it doesn't necessarily take care of if you got deplatformed from the other place. And it, like you said, it doesn't have the appeal that Patreon does of its years of amassing an audience there. So it could be maybe he could use it in conjunction with.
Right. Yeah, that or it could be. You know, this is something that I was speculating. Actually, I didn't have, I don't know why I said that. I didn't have JJ. I had Naomi on to talk about it.
Okay.
But either way, one of the things I speculated with her was that for a long time, there have been, I mean, you know how Bitcoin folks are. They are real proselytizers for Bitcoin. Right? They want to talk about it to everybody they meet. And not everybody they meet is that interested. And they feel like they're hitting a brick wall and they get frustrated. And I said, maybe the thing that helps Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general breakthrough is this issue right here, which is that the average person, let's say, who has views that are not in the mainstream, you know, they're not Joe Biden or Mitt Romney, you know, they have different views. They find that these views are running into censorship problems and restrictions, that maybe some of these people may have also thought Bitcoin was a bad idea or not worth their time, but suddenly it is, because suddenly it's the only game in town that really can provide them with what they need, which is a way of making payments to other people where there isn't some party that can intervene and say, well, we don't like that person, so you shouldn't be allowed to send money to that person through our mechanism. I think this problem, because I think this social media problem is not going away. There are a lot of very, very angry, deeply unhappy people. And when I think the smoke clears, I don't see what the other solution is other than cryptocurrency. This may be a boon. This may genuinely be a boon for the whole crypto world. I mean, I hope so.
Mm-hmm, me too. Yeah. It does seem like it could be a viable solution. But it's just, how do you get the masses? Like, how many people does Jordan Peterson have on his Patreon? How do you get all of them to then learn this stuff? Like, it's so easy to put your credit card in. But
it's
to go,
true.
I'm not trying to talk bad about Bitcoin. I love Bitcoin, but I just, it's so hard to use right now compared to, I mean, getting on Coinbase isn't that hard, but I just feel like there's such a negative attitude, especially the people that didn't get into Bitcoin early. Like now, if you try and talk to them, like it feels like they're happy that it's gone down this year, even though if you look like year over year, we're at 3,000. I think 3 years ago we're at 300. So it's still a huge price increase over time at this, even with the giant drop of 2018. But I don't know, the sentiment just seems like we're still far away from something like Patreon level.
Oh yeah, no question about it. But if first of all, it's significant to me that somebody with the stature and following of a Jordan Peterson is willing to stand up to Patreon, a platform that earns him a fortune.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he's willing to do that is very significant. So he is willing to buck some trends, and that's a big one. If he really wanted to do it, and he decided ultimately, I don't see any way we can do this that doesn't open us up to censorship dangers yet again, other than through cryptocurrency. Yeah, it's true. He wouldn't be able to bring all his people on board, and maybe he couldn't bring 20% of them. I don't know. But if Jordan Peterson, along with some tech savvy fan of Jordan Peterson, made a video together where for 15 minutes they explained what Bitcoin is, and then they just walk you through step by step. Because all they need at the beginning is a Coinbase account. Mm-hmm. Then they can learn about wallets and they can do all the whatever else they want to do. But at least get them thinking about it and using it. That's step one.
And Coinbase lets people do reoccurring payments too. So they could have Coinbase has all the features that right. you'd ever need for this. So all they'd have to do would be set up, you know, a recurring payment monthly to whatever site they ended up using for crypto. But then we have Coinbase as the, you know, what if Coinbase decides that what they said, like they did with Gab, is too controversial?
Right.
I hope Coinbase wouldn't do that. But
at least it's an entry point into the world of Bitcoin for these folks mm-hmm. without throwing everything at, you know, it's a Coinbase is user friendly. That's the benefit. And then little by little you get, but I mean, I'm just saying that people of these of his stature, if he were to say, let's take a look into this, I mean, these are people who are sending him money, even though they know he's earning well in excess of $1 million a year already. They know that. And they still want to send him money. I mean, these people are dedicated. These are like Bitcoin people, yeah. right? Take some of that zeal, right, and redirect it into this world. And who knows what may come of it. Do you have a website or you have a podcast? Tell us about that.
Oh yeah, it's called the HODLcast, and I started out just as I was going through with all my clients, I came up with a lot of new questions. And in any other area of law, you can, you know, type it into Google, and there's hundreds of other lawyers have already shared their opinions on it. You have step by step guides of how to handle certain situations, and in crypto law, that just didn't exist. So I started writing blogs. And then basically just reading my blog into a podcast format. And then that was kind of boring. So I started having guests on, and I do one or two a week, and the audience is still quite small at the moment, but it's fun. And it really helps me stay on the edge of the various legal topics that come up. And it's been a lot of fun.
So HODLcast, for those not in the know, this would be spelled mm-hmm. HODLcast. Now for HODL, you got to go look that one up. I've mentioned it on the show before, but if you don't know what that is, you got to go just look that one up. It'll take you 2 seconds on Google. So we'll link to that because I see you have a YouTube channel. Is that, but let's see, I also see the podcast over here. So do you distribute it through all the usual outlets?
Right. I put it out on YouTube and on SoundCloud and iTunes.
Okay. All right. So we'll link to HODLcast over at tomwoods.com/1318.
Oh, thank you.
Which is the show notes page for today. Well, I appreciate this conversation. As I told you before we went on, I have far less knowledge in this area than I really should. And I always feel self-conscious about it. And
no, I think you know more than you think.
Oh, well, thanks.
The questions you're asking are excellent. And,
good. Okay. All right. But it helps that I know what I don't know, right, in this situation. And you know all the things I don't know, which makes this episode a perfect match. Well, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
And that will do it for us for today. Remember, if you don't yet have my new ebook, Our Enemy, the Fed, how can you not? Cost you nothing, and boy, ain't that a juicy title. Obviously, I ripped off Albert J. Nock, Our Enemy, the State, but Our Enemy, the Fed's a pretty darn good title. You can pick that up at OurEnemyTheFed.com. That is your weekend assignment. Also, your weekend assignment, I have a bonus episode coming up with a guy I've known for several years now who has a lot to teach you when it comes to business and success and risk-taking because, man, did this guy roll the dice and risk it all. And he lived to tell about it. So that's going to be a fun bonus episode for you this week. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.